Hey, everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping, too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Expecting heavy downpours all day today.
You're a builder. You build. It's literally in your job title.
Woo, let's hit it.
A little rain isn't stopping you. Not today, not any day. Shouldn't your flashing tape be working through it all, too? Only Frog Tape Pro-Grade Flashing Tape's high-performance acrylic adhesive sticks, re-sticks, and stays stuck, even on the roughest surfaces in rain, snow, heat, and more. So you stay in control when it matters most. Show weather who's boss with Frog Tape Pro-Grade Flashing Tape.
This is a special presentation of Macabre, a dark history podcast. We delve into the shadows of the past where history's most sinister tales reside. These are the stories that cannot be confined to a single episode, narratives that demand a deeper exploration and immersion into the human condition. Prepare to immerse yourself in accounts of chilling crimes, unsolved mysteries, and the darker side of human nature in this Macabre feature. Welcome, dear listeners, to your first Macabre feature. Tonight, we descend into the abyss of Victorian London, a city of stark contrast where opulence and squalor existed side by side. Our journey begins in the autumn of 1888, a time when fear hung heavy in the air and a predator stalked the shadows, and the name Jack the Ripper was about to be etched in history with blood. Imagine London in 1888. A sprawling metropolis, a beacon of progress and civilization. Yet, beneath the veneer of grandeur, a darkness festered. The East End, a labyrinth of twisting alleyways and towering brick tenements, was a world apart. Here, poverty reigned supreme. Factories coughed up plumes of black smoke that blotted out the sun. And the River Thames, the city's lifeblood, carried the stench of industrial waste. Whitechapel, a district within the East End, was the heart of this despair, a teeming warren of humanity where the desperate sought refuge in overcrowded lodging houses, and the flickering gas lamps cast long, dancing shadows that seemed to whisper secrets. By day, the streets buzzed with a chaotic energy, costermongers hawking their wares, dock workers unloading their burdens, and children darting through the throngs, their nimble fingers ever ready to snatch a coin. But as night fell, an unsettling stillness descended. The air grew heavy, the shadows deepened, and fear became a tangible presence. Whitechapel in 1888 was a cauldron of vice and desperation. Gambling dens, gin palaces, and brothels lined the streets, offering fleeting escape from the harsh realities of life. The Industrial Revolution had brought wealth to some, but here, in the East End, it had only widened the chasm between the rich and the poor. Men, women, and children toiled in factories for meager wages, barely enough to keep body and soul together. Workhouses overflowed with the destitute, and for many women, survival meant walking the streets, offering their bodies for a few precious shillings. It's estimated that over 1,000 women lived this precarious existence as prostitutes in Whitechapel. Many were older, their lives worn down by hardship, abandoned by families, and stripped of all dignity. Night after night, they braved the dangers of the streets, clutching threadbare shawls for warmth, their hearts pounding with a mixture of fear and a desperate hope for enough money to secure a bed for the night. Or perhaps just enough gin to numb the gnawing hunger and the ever-present despair. It is here in the darkness that our story unfolds. Here, five women, each with her own story of struggle and resilience, became the prey of a monstrous killer. Their lives, often overlooked and marginalized by society, deserve to be remembered, not just as victims, but as individuals who lived, breathed, and dreamed in the squalor of Whitechapel. Before we delve further, I must warn you, dear listeners, this is not a tale for the faint of heart. We will be exploring acts of unspeakable violence, delving into the darkest recesses of the human soul. There will be graphic descriptions of injuries and the grim reality of death. If you are sensitive to such content, I urge you to proceed with caution. Our story begins with Mary Ann Nichols, a woman known to her friends as Polly. She was 43 years old and a mother of 5 children, and like so many others, a casualty of Whitechapel's unforgiving streets. Born Mary Ann Walker on August 26, 1845, Polly's life was a tapestry of both joy and sorrow. In 1864, she married William Nichols, a printer's machinist, and together they built a family, welcoming 5 children between 1866 and 1879. But life in Whitechapel was rarely kind. Like many women, Polly found herself resorting to common lodging houses and occasional prostitution to survive the relentless grip of poverty. In 1877, a shadow fell over Polly's life. For reasons unknown, she began drinking heavily, a desperate attempt, perhaps, to escape the crushing weight of her circumstances. This led to a series of separations from her husband, and by 1880, their lives had diverged. Polly's path became increasingly difficult, marked by a struggle with alcoholism and a nomadic existence between lodging houses in the grim confines of the workhouse. Yet despite her hardships, those who knew her described her as a quiet and inoffensive woman. The last hours of Polly Nichols' life are a haunting sequence of events. On the evening of August 30th, around 11 p.m., she was seen walking along Whitechapel Road. Later, she visited the Frying Pan Public House in Brick Lane, leaving there around 12:30 a.m., by 1:20 a.m. on August 31st, she had returned to her lodging houses on Flower and Dean Street. But fate dealt her a cruel blow. The deputy lodging housekeeper demanded the money for her lodging that night, and Polly, penniless, was turned away. "I'll soon get my DOS money," she replied with chilling optimism. "See what a jolly bonnet I've got now." It's believed she intended to earn that money the only way she knew how, by selling herself on the streets. The last person to see Polly alive was Emily Holland, a fellow resident of the Thrall Street Lodging House. It was approximately 2:30 a.m. on August 31st, a mere hour before Polly's life would be brutally extinguished. Holland recalled seeing Polly stumbling along Osborne Street, her steps unsteady, her breath heavy with drink. At one point, Polly leaned against the wall of a grocer's shop, struggling to maintain her balance. Holland, her heart perhaps touched by a flicker of pity, urged Polly to return to the relative safety of the Thrall Street lodging house. But Polly refused, a weary smile playing on her lips. She claimed to have earned her lodging money multiple times already that night, but had spent it all, likely on the oblivion offered by alcohol. Unwilling to return to her lodgings, Polly vanished into the oppressive darkness of Whitechapel. It was the last time anyone saw her alive. The morning of August 31st, 1888, dawned like any other in Whitechapel, oblivious to the horror that had unfolded in its shadows. Charles Cross, a cartman, began his day early, making his way along the dimly lit Buck Row. The air was damp, and the silence was broken only by the distant sounds of the city and the scurrying of rats in the gutters. As Charles Cross made his way along Buck's Row, his eyes fell upon an unsettling sight, a dark shape, lying on the ground near the entrance to a stable yard. Initially, he dismissed it as a bundle of discarded rags. But as he drew closer, a sense of dread washed over him. It was a woman's body, sprawled out on the cold cobblestones. Moments later, another cart driver, Robert Paul, approached Cross. Cross, his voice trembling, pointed towards the figure on the ground. Together, they cautiously approached. The dim light revealed a motionless woman, lying on her back, her eyes wide open, her legs straight, her skirt pulled up, revealing the vulnerability of her exposed lower body. Cross, his heart pounding in his chest, reached down and gently touched her face and hands. To his horror, her face was still warm, a stark contrast to the icy coldness of her hands. Paul pressed his hand against her chest, and though he thought he felt a faint breath, it was weak, barely perceptible. Fearful of being implicated in the crime, the two men made a fateful decision. Instead of immediately raising an alarm, they pulled the woman's skirts down, a final act of dignity for a life so brutally ended, before hurrying away to find a police officer. It wasn't long before Constable John Neal arrived on the scene, his boots echoing on the cobblestones. Under the flickering glow of a gas lamp, the full horror of the scene was revealed. Polly Nichols had been brutally murdered. Her throat had been slashed twice, the wounds deep and ragged, one 8 inches long, the other 4 almost severing her head from her body, with the cuts reaching deep into her vertebral column. But the horror didn't end there. Her abdomen was savagely mutilated, a gaping wound that exposed some of her bowels. Other injuries, even more grotesque, were discovered during the medical examination, including stabbing wounds to her vagina and multiple stab wounds down the right side of her body. It's believed that this vicious attack took the killer a mere 4 to 5 minutes, a whirlwind of violence that left Polly Nichols no chance of survival. The cuts to her throat would have been instantly fatal, and the abdominal wounds were likely inflicted after her death. The medical examiner noted the lack of significant blood splatter and blood loss at the scene, leading to the chilling conclusion that the killer possessed a disturbing level of anatomical knowledge, a detail that would later fuel speculation about the killer's identity. The brutality of the attack spoke volumes, a chilling testament to the rage and madness that drove the killer's hand. The police, confronted with the sheer horror of the scene, were thrust into the heart of a case that would soon grip London in a vice of terror. Polly Nichols' life, a stark reflection of the hardship and poverty endured by countless women in Victorian Whitechapel, became a tragic symbol of the Ripper's brutal legacy. The investigation into her murder marked the beginning of a dark chapter in London's history, the hunt for Jack the Ripper. It's important to remember that in chaos and the fear of Whitechapel, trust was a rare commodity. Even the discovery of Polly Nichols' body was shrouded in fear, with the Carters initially hesitant to report what they found, afraid of becoming suspects themselves. The police were often viewed with suspicion, and the fear of retaliation was a powerful force that kept many silent. Before we move on to our next victim, let's take a moment to examine the initial investigation into Polly Nichols' murder and the key witnesses who came forward. Charles Cross, the carter who made the grim discovery of Polly's body, his testimony was crucial in establishing the timeline of events. Robert Paul, the second carter who corroborated Cross's account, was a key witness. Constable John Neal was the first police officer to arrive at the crime scene. Residents of Bucks Row, while many were interviewed, their accounts offered little in the way of concrete leads. And Dr. Llewellyn, the medical examiner whose detailed report provided crucial insights into the nature of the crime. The initial investigation into Polly Nichols' murder was a race against time, a desperate attempt to catch a killer who seemed to simply melt into the shadows. The investigators' initial thoughts and observations paint a chilling picture. The sheer savagery of the attack was undeniable. The deep, slashing wounds to the throat and the extensive abdominal mutilation pointed to a killer driven by violent, perhaps frenzied rage. This level of violence was uncommon, even in the brutal landscape of Whitechapel. Possible motives? Robbery was quickly ruled out as a motive, as nothing of value appeared to have been taken from Polly Nichols. The nature of the injury suggested a more sinister motive, perhaps a sexually motivated attack or the work of a deranged psychopath. In the immediate aftermath of the murder, there were no clear suspects. Polly Nichols' transient lifestyle and numerous interactions with people made it very difficult to identify anyone with a clear motive or simply a connection to the crime. The details of the investigation unfolded like a grim scene. Bucks Row, a dark and secluded street, became the focal point of the investigation. The location of Polly's body, discovered early in the morning, was meticulously examined. However, in this pre-forensic era, the resources available to investigators were woefully limited. There was no way to preserve fingerprints or trace evidence, a stark reminder of the challenges faced by Victorian law enforcement. Given Polly's residence in a common lodging house, investigators embarked on a grim tour of these establishments, attempting to piece together her movements in the days leading up to her death, and an attempt to identify anyone who might have seen her or had reason to harm her. The post-mortem examination of Polly Nichols' body was critical. The detailed description of the injuries provided crucial insights into the method of killing and the possible weapon used. A knife, estimated to be 6 to 8 inches in length, possibly a shoemaker's knife or a cork cutter. The medical examiner's report became a key piece of evidence, a chilling testament to the killer's brutality. The murder of Polly Nichols and the subsequent killings ignited a firestorm of media attention. Newspapers sensationalized the case, fueling public fear and hysteria, adding immense pressure to an already burdened police force. The investigation, as I mentioned, was severely hampered by the absence of modern forensic technology. In 1888, fingerprinting, DNA analysis, and other techniques that are commonplace today were simply non-existent. This lack of scientific tools made it incredibly difficult to identify and track down the killer, leaving investigators to rely on eyewitness accounts and circumstantial evidence, both of which proved to be unreliable. The investigation into Polly Nichols' murder, despite the thoroughness of the efforts for its time, ultimately proved unsuccessful. The killer, or killers, left no readily discernible trace evidence, and the police were unable to establish a clear motive or identify a prime suspect. This initial failure set the stage for the frustrating and ultimately unsolved investigation into the Jack the Ripper murders, a mystery that continues to haunt us to this day. The terror in Whitechapel did not end with Polly Nichols. In fact, it was only the beginning. The next chapter of our story plunges us deeper into the heart of the Ripper's dark deeds. I will examine the final four canonical victims, the escalating panic that gripped London, and the desperate, often flawed attempts to hunt down a killer who seemed to vanish like a ghost. I do hope you join me again for our next macabre feature, Episode 2, The Eyes of Whitechapel and the Hunt for Jack the Ripper.